From the Sky News Centre at 6, the wife of a church organist beaten to death in Sheffield on Christmas Eve says she hasn't read a letter from the man who admitted his murder. 22-year-old Jonathan Bowling had been jailed for life this afternoon and will spend at least 25 years in prison. Another man was given a 9-year term for manslaughter. The heatwave has sparked wildfires across the UK. Blazes have been reported in Dorset, South Wales, North East Fife and in London. The Met Office has been warning of an elevated risk of fires as a result of the hot temperatures and dry conditions. Kevin Herneman from the Fire Brigades Union says people must be careful.
With budgetary cuts in the fire service, they haven't got resources to deal with huge grass fires. Whilst they're dealing with that, they're not dealing with anything else. All I say to people is be sensible, just be careful what you do with the barbecue, just be careful what you do with your cigarettes.
Police in the West Midlands say they have no information to suggest those who visit mosques in the area are at risk from a bombing campaign. Within the last month, 3 separate devices have been detonated near mosques. Environmental groups say plans to give tax breaks to the shale gas industry will damage communities and increase climate change. The Chancellor wants to encourage the extraction of gas deep underground, claiming it would boost jobs, reduce energy imports and bring down household bills. In sport, England's cricketers are looking to build a big lead in the second Ashes test after opting not to force Australia to follow on. Guy Swindles is live at Lord's for us.
England 23 for 2 in their second innings, and if England was supposed to win this match easily, no one told the Australian Peter Siddle, who has bowled both Cook and Trott. And although England lead by 256, certainly life being made slightly uncomfortable for them at the moment on day 2 of this second Investec Ashes test match. 23 for 2.
Thanks. And Michael Angel Jimenez is the new clubhouse leader of the Open Golf. That's the latest. I'm Chloe Culpin.
There are many great places to eat and drink around Bristol, and the Social Bar and Cafe is no exception. We offer great deals throughout the week, whether you want a quiet coffee with a friend, a large workspace, or just a tasty home-cooked meal. We serve delicious, fresh and locally sourced food till 10 and roasts on Sundays. That's the Social Bar and Cafe, 130 Cheltenham Road, Stokes Croft, near the Tesco Express. To browse our menu and find out more, go to thesocialbristol.co.uk.
You could be driving in your car.
You could be walking your dog. You might just be working. But whatever you're doing, you're also listening to BCFM 93.2. And if you're in business, your potential new customers could be listening too. So talk to them and let them know what you have to offer. Radio advertising is a cost-effective and proven way to get your message across, and BCFM 93.2 could put together an affordable campaign that could work for you. For details, call 0560 112 6659 or email sales@bcfm.org.uk.
The Desi Ranking Show on BCFM.
Say good morning, going out to Lorraine Giangiana. Mr. Paul V, how are you doing? Good morning! What, you mean this one, P? Do you mean this one? I'm not sure which one you mean, P. And the song. Okay, great sounds coming all the way from Luigiano. Okay, gotta say good morning. That's why I always say to people.
The Desi Ranking Show on BCFM.
Tune in each and every Sunday between the hours of 10 and 12. In the meantime.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show Friday Drive Time with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We go to the sharp homeless end of the coalition government's social security cuts tonight with a Bristolian who's stepping in where the government has failed. Well, it's tax-free mansions for the super rich, but if you don't have a job, tough. You've got a choice. Either go to a food bank, or if you've got one, get evicted from your home. There's between 15 and 19,000 officially homeless in Bristol, and the failure of central government or local councils to build housing. One Bristolian, Tony Crofts, is determined to change all that, provide a safe investment for Bristolians, and to invest the money in converting offices, empty ones, to social housing. Yes, he's doing the council's job for them. And as the man himself seems to be recovering well in hospital, Bristol celebrates Nelson Mandela's birthday tomorrow. Phil McCowan is one of the organisers. He'll be here to explain why this former terrorist is a man worth celebrating, and also what kind of parties being planned. But to start, we welcome to the studio Tony Crofts from AEOB House People, is a new organisation in the city dedicated to turning empty office blocks into accommodation. Hi Tony, welcome to Drive Time.
Bristol City Council only managed to build 200 affordable homes last year and will barely make 40 this year, so the problem will never be solved. At the same time, it's been forced to sell off 13,860 council houses, changing them from affordable homes into high-cost investment properties, and it's acquired 60 acres of empty offices. This is because we're stuck in a world where speculating businessmen are gambling on the land value, the value of land that they are sitting on doing nothing with.
Okay, so what do you plan to do about all this, Tony? I mean, you've been on here before talking about this as a problem. I'm glad to see you've gone away and done something about it.
We need to raise money to get some of this property off out of the hands of speculators and start doing what needs to be done with it. We're launching a community share so people can invest in it.
Oh, well, why would people want to invest in your project rather than just put money in the bank?
Because they want Bristol to be a better place than it is at present.
But ultimately, aren't you? I mean, the thing is, when you're investing money, Tony, it's all about how much return you're going to get and how safe that return is. It's always a bit of a gamble. I mean, surely it's going to be difficult to persuade people to invest in a completely new scheme. It's an unknown.
It's not such a gamble. If it's secured on land and property that is good and sound, it will be perfectly all right. And it will in due course be able to produce a 3 to 5% return. And because we're doing it as a cooperative community interest company, the shares that people buy when they invest will be in due course returnable.
Well, that's actually a lot better than you're getting as a normal interest rates if you invest in a building inside your bank at the moment. Ron, you're still here. You're from the Labour Party, Deputy Leader of the Labour Party. You've also been a long-time campaigner on housing. What do you make of Tony's initiative?
Well, I think Tony's initiative is running very close and parallel to a number of ideas that I've put into the Labour Group's housing policy. He's talking about a people's share. We're talking about a Bristol bond. I think it's the same approach. There's 400,000 people in the city with relatively small amounts of money. If they invest it, as you suggest, in a bank, they get maybe tuppence a month, etc. Absolute rubbish return. What I'm looking to do, and for money, would be to look for what I call ethical investment from pension funds, and to invest, as Tony rightly says, in the security of land and property in the city. As soon as you get planning permission, the base value of the site goes up. There's nothing on the stock market that can guarantee the trustees of a pension fund that guarantee. And indeed, if we run the Bristol bond through the agencies of the credit unions, we don't get the overheads of banks. There's 85 sites that the City Council owns or has serious influence over in the city, within the city boundary, not going into the green belt, capable of building 7,000 homes. And I'm asking and looking for 4,000 in relation to the policy of the Labour Party, on the basis that there will take time for this to grow, and there will be some issues in relation to the smaller sites. And I've got a picture here. This is a local company in Bristol East, in Hannam. It can build this, and I'm showing the picture.
It's not too good on radio. It looks like a little cabin.
It's basically, it's a two-story, two-bedroom property, fully fitted, completely eco-sensitive, green, etc., that can be built for £16,000 a unit. And it's by a local company in Hannam. And I know you can't see it on here, but it
looks
all
right.
Very nice.
Looks rather nice, yeah. Ron, let me just get this clear, though. Is this, maybe slightly at cross purposes with what Tony's doing as an ordinary citizen. Are you thinking, then, that you're hoping that Tony is going to pioneer this and show examples? Are there any other examples of other places in the country which have done what you're suggesting?
Yes. London boroughs of Islington have done it. They put 10% of their pension fund into and that's 800 million. Manchester built 233 homes this year by that method. I'm close to hopefully getting our officers to look at building the first 195 through this possible route. And I don't see any conflict between what Tony's trying to do as an individual and us as politicians. I think we're all both on the same issue. I'm chair of the cross-party working group on affordable housing, and I'm trying to get a completely open agenda outside of the box from what we're doing now for all the issues that Tony's rightly shown, to improve that number and to go through cooperatives, small groups, anything that we can do. And he's right in relation to the offices, because the estate agents have brought out a total of 71,000 potential flats in empty buildings. So he's totally right. I support him 200%.
So this is the estate agents themselves are saying, well, look, you know, you've got the equivalent of 71,000 flats here.
Yeah.
Incredible.
And that's their information, far more accurate than I would have by guesswork.
It's almost as if they want those properties to be sold. Obviously, you know, there's a motive for the estate agents to do that, a profit motive, but they want to see those properties sold. They realise that no one's going to necessarily buy them for to remain as an empty office, but someone may be able to buy them and develop them into housing. Tony Crofts, what can and can't the council do? Because you're as an individual, you've got a bit more freedom, haven't you?
The council can't do this for itself. It needs to have cooperatives or community land trusts to do it for it,
exactly,
because
right,
they're able to own the property on behalf of the community and keep it permanently affordable, not being subject to right to buy. Whereas anything the council produces is immediately liable to be sold off and turned into a speculative asset again.
Well, this is a bit strange, Ron. Why is that?
Well, we're still suffering a little bit from, if you like, the Thatcherite era. One of the other things we're trying to do is to lift the cap on borrowing on the housing revenue account, and all councils are trapped in this same national legislation.
So the money's coming in from existing housing you've got, but you're not allowed to invest it, is that what you're saying?
That's right. I mean, obviously part of that goes on repairs, maintenance and upkeep of the estate we've got, because we've got 28,000 single tenancies in Bristol. But the headroom for potential is only 11 million after everything, and then if you take out the maintenance in it, the amount we would have to actually invest anywhere is very, very small. What we need to do is what the government is telling us that we shouldn't be doing, and that is borrowing money to actually create jobs and to create homes, etc. They know full well, and you've got it in your news sheets, that how many of the hundreds of thousands of houses are not available. And the bedroom tax is another issue, where Bristol's got very, very little single flats or single accommodation, bedroom accommodation, for people to move out, which is why they're being forced into the private sector. So I would support everything that Tony's doing in relation to return. Our return would be a premium return on the investment for any investors, and the people in the bond would get exactly the same for their 50 quid as somebody who put in 50 million. That would be 3-5%, exactly the same.
That'd be interesting to see you two sort of trying to compete for investors with your two different schemes once yours comes along.
And it would be good to see, because in the end people would buy into it, and we would actually be able to move the blockage that we've got with families that are on the city council waiting list currently, that will never get a home. if we stick to working within the box, and I support Tony 100%.
Tony, what is this business of ownership, though? Can you explain that? Because you're saying that you don't necessarily want to go down the council road because of this idea that people might actually be able to buy the house at some point. I mean, surely, if you're going to build a place, you should be giving somebody who's going to live in it the right to buy it.
But as soon as you sell a low-cost house, it becomes a high-cost house, which defeats the whole object of the thing. And the trouble with the office blocks is that the property pimps want to turn them into luxury flats. And we don't need more office blocks or luxury flats. We need homes for people.
OK, so tell us about what you're doing on Monday, because I think we're getting a bit of a preview here, aren't we? You're going to be launching this on Monday, officially.
On Monday, we're going to be launching our community share outside the most prominent office block in Bristol, Colston's Tower.
But the Colston Tower is not empty.
No, but it has already been rumoured to be being planned to turn into luxury flats because it's been empty as an office block for about, I don't know how many years.
Okay, you've got the community share, but what particular specific places have you been looking at? How did you find those places? Because I know you've got your BDI on a couple of empty offices to be your first.
Our eye on an empty site and next to it two offices in Whitehall Road, which if we can get them together and get planning permission, would be capable of carrying 26 to 28 flats.
Well, it might not sound a lot, but it's a start.
It's a big lump to present to the council towards its deficit in social housing.
Okay, Ron, like I say to Tony, it's not a lot of actual flats, 26, but it seems more than the council's able to do or anybody else.
Well, let's be clear about it. As Tony's rightly pointed out, over the last 3 years, the number of affordable homes that the council's been able to build because of the cut situation, etc., has gone down. It's gone down from about 400 or 500 right the way down, and there's doubt whether it will reach anywhere near 150 this year. You know, everything's up in the air. In relation to the actual build that the council's been able to do in relation to modernising council houses, that's 12 a year for 2 years. It's pathetic. And this is why I'm saying that whilst the council officers seem to be trapped almost like rabbits in the headlights and stuck with what they know, they have got to think outside of the box and start again. There's nothing wrong with what we're doing and what we can do within house, but we've got to do something really radical outside of all normal thinking to start again, to give housing, which is in crisis in Bristol, a real kickstart.
And something that we do need to look at is the number of empty shops around. If we can get hold of empty shops, convert the upper floors into flats, and then renovate the ground floors and turn them into studio workshops and places where people can work, so people can work where they live, it'll be a great advance.
Tony, how are you planning to explain a bit about the ownership of these places? Because I'm slightly confused in that you're saying that people won't actually be able to own the places themselves. So who will own them? What kind of body?
They probably will be able to buy equity shares, but they won't own the freeholds. They can't sell it on the open market at speculative prices.
Well, why is that?
Well, this is what worked terribly well in America, where they have renovated whole sections of cities and sold the homes at low premiums to low-income families who, when they move on, get back the original money they put in plus the value of any improvements they've put in.
This seems like a sort of halfway...
So they're able to build a capital nub, but at the same time, the homes are still kept permanently affordable.
It seems a halfway house between actually owning it and renting it. But how does that work? You actually would spend a bit of money on the house that you're living in, and then if you were to move out, you'd get that back. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, that upgraded for what any increase in the value of the building while you were there. I mean, the thing is, you've got to decide, you know, whether you're aiming to make individual people richer or to provide affordable homes, and it's two different policy aims.
Okay, so you're launching your community share on Monday at what time?
5 o'clock.
5 p.m.
Yep.
Outside the Colston, by the Colston Tower. And what are you really expecting? Are you expecting people to actually invest in this business?
Yes, I expect there will be people of conscience, ethical investors in the city who will be prepared to put money into cooperative shares to get money so that we can actually acquire some of this property that is at present being held overpriced, off the market and out of use.
Ron, this is only, like I say, small, isn't it?
Yeah.
But is there any chance of actually this happening more? Because we're desperately in need of even affordable housing. That term affordable housing for many millions of people out there is actually not affordable at all, is it?
Well, let me give you an illustration. I just learned today that the first house I ever bought in Manworthy Road in Brislington for £1,896 in 1964 is back on the market at £170,000. That's the problem that people have got. And in relation to the right to buy, it is the fact that once you start to sell, you then become captive of the market level and the market price. And this starts to push housing out of the reach of the very people that need it. And so I think that we need to go down this route. If you look at the Bristol City Council pension fund, it's got £2 billion in it.
Uh-huh. That's quite a lot of money. Tony, finally, as a way of jumping the gun for Monday, can you just give us your details, whereabouts we can find your project on the internet, your investment on the internet, and phone and email, that sort of thing?
AEOB House People, all one word, .org.uk.
So that's against empty office buildings, yeah?
Yes.
Okay, AEOB House People.
.org.uk.
Right, that's the website.
And the email is Beales, BEALESH, at gmail.com. And a phone number to phone is 0117 926 5931.
Well, that's Tony Cross there. Thanks very much. And a pat on the back, Tony, for a fantastic job done. Ron, finally, why has the council not been able to do this?
Not going to do it.
Why has the council not been able to do this? What Tony's done?
Well, it's because I'm afraid we've got a thinking process in the city council. It's looked to know and use what they know. And it's been 18 months now to start shifting that perspective, as I said, outside the box, to think radically and to recognise the crisis of housing in Bristol. And it started, but it's a very slow process because I'm afraid the bureaucracy of councils moves slowly.
The frustrating thing for me is if you look at how much it actually costs to build a house in terms of man hours or woman hours putting into it, that is to say material costs and labour to build a house, they should cost around about £1 a week. Mm-hmm. They last for about 200 years. Anyway, thanks both of you for joining us, and hopefully we'll get this crisis sorted out and some of these 15,000 people housed. That's Ron Stone from Deputy Leader of Bristol Labour Party, and also Tony Crofts from AEOB House People. Thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now I'm joined by Martin Summers. Martin, what was your thoughts this week about the final, it seems, denouement with Edward Snowden, who it now looks as if going to be taking asylum in Russia? This is this NSA whistleblower.
Well, I mean, effectively, he was offered asylum in various Latin American countries, but he was not allowed to fly from Moscow to those countries because the West basically said if he tries to leave Russia and fly to Latin America, we will intercept the plane, etc., etc. So he was stuck in Moscow. And I understand that the situation at the moment is that the Russians are offering him temporary asylum because they think that he should go to Latin America as well, which is where he wants to go. But well, the West won't let him.
One of the things they've said is that he will give him asylum on the understanding that he doesn't make any more embarrassing leaks. Isn't this just posturing?
Well, I think what the Russians might be suggesting there is don't tell everybody, tell us. We want to know what's been going on there because we're possibly going to war with the United States over Syria, so we'd like all sorts of information you've got. But I think the reality is that the international situation is very, very tense. fence, and Snowden camping out in Moscow airport is one of the pawns in that game.
I mean, we've had the European powers and the European Union getting very cross with the United States because of the revelations that they've been spying via Edward Snowden. They've been spying on the European Union, the European Parliament, and yet they are also denying transit rights for Edward Snowden over to South America if he wants to go there. So what's the reality behind this? You've got completely different opinions there. On one hand, they're saying we're very upset with the United States. On the other hand, they're actually going exactly along with US.
Well, even conservative German politicians, for example, are suggesting that Snowden should come and live in Germany because they're very annoyed at the US snooping on them. And, of course, there's supposedly a big trade deal between the EU and NAFTA being cooked up. But how can you do a trade deal with people who are listening to your communications? You can't negotiate in good faith with people who are basically listening to your communications and working out what your bottom lines are and so on and so forth.
But, I mean, they're
so
very close.
The trade deal is on the rocks as a result.
Martin, it's the same big multinational companies in Europe and the United States, so best pals anyway. So this trade deal has probably already been sorted out by them.
No, well, indeed. But I mean, you'll understand that there are differences of interest between the Germans and the British and the Americans and so forth. And you know, you can't really do a deal with people when there's cheating going on, if you like.
What about the Germans spying on the British and the British spying on the Germans and the French spying on the EU?
Well, the reality is that everybody's spying on everybody else. I mean, that's the modern world we live in, and we could say, well, that's all right then. The real problem which people haven't faced up to and need to face up to is that the Western intelligence services have a long track record of being implicated in terrorism. So why would you want these people to have the right to look at people's emails when they are in fact suspects in terrorist attacks? And I say that very advisedly because
no, they're not. No, because the Intelligence and Security Committee this week has come out and said that GCHQ has not in any way tried to circumvent the law using this prison.
Well, I mean, in the immortal words of Mandy Rice Davis, they would say that, wouldn't they? Don't forget, these people are spooks, and it's their job is to lie
and
deceive.
No, they are. Now, hang on a minute. No, because the Intelligence and Security Committee, right, the way the intelligence services work in this country is all top secret stuff, except it's overseen by two committees, the Joint Intelligence Committee, which is a whole load of civil servants. It was recently chaired by Alex Allen, I think, who's also now oversees the parliamentary standards in the House of Commons and the House of Lords. But Alex Allen had a bit of a strange bender. He was a big Grateful Dead fan, and he was found with blood all over him or something. It's some very, very strange episode about 4 or 5 years ago. But that's the civil servants running the intelligence services. Above that, you've got the Democratic Oversight, which is the Intelligence and Security Committee, with Sir Malcolm Rifkin chairing it.
All right. The head of the Italian Supreme Court, Fernando Imposimato, I've said this on this show before, published a book in December in Italy entitled La Repubblica dei Strani Impuni, which translated means the Republic of the Unpunished Massacres. And it's based upon 30 years of investigation by the Italian police force. And it's absolutely clear to the head of the Italian Supreme Court that NATO intelligence services bombed Bologna railway station in 1980, killing 80 people. They bombed Piazza Fontana in 1969. Killing 9 people. They were involved in the kidnap of Aldo Moro, who was the Prime Minister of Italy, and his assassination. And that is the considered opinion of the head of the Italian Supreme Court, based upon investigations by the Italian police force. Now, what you find in Middle England is people say, oh, no, that's just silly. It's not just silly, of course, because the Western intelligence services, and this definitely includes MI6 and the CIA, are known to be terrorists. Known to be terrorists. Not conspiracy theory. This is all factual. There's a book by Daniel Ganser, who is an academic in Switzerland, called NATO's Secret Armies, which covers all of this. And if anybody's interested in this, all they've got to do is do an internet search for the term GLADIO, GLADIO, which was the code name for all of these operations. Now, when they talk, basically, Western intelligence services are no better than they ought to be. It's quite possible that Putin's FSB bombed Moscow in 1999, which was certainly the allegation that Litvinenko made. So it's not just the Western intelligence services who are terrorists. Virtually all of them are terrorists. And so when we're talking about the intelligence services protecting us from terrorism, it's an absurdity. The Operation Cyclone in the 1980s, in which MI6 was the lead agency, was the biggest secret operation in history, arming the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and setting up Al-Qaeda in Jordan.
Martin, this is a long time ago. Most recently, the Parliamentary Committee, The Guardian tells us, that Patrick Winter says, the political editor, that the Parliamentary Committee was too busy to question intelligence agencies. The Intelligence and Security Committee postponed a televised session with agencies to focus on GCHQ claims, and that was on Monday, the 1st of July. So it does look as if there's a sort of nervousness amongst this. I mean, you would think, I mean, as with things like the Leveson inquiry, this would all be done in front of the cameras, that when the bosses of these agencies are alleged to have broken the law, that when they're questioned by a parliamentary committee, it would be done openly. But no, apparently it looks like this is so secret, we're not allowed to do it. And also the Intelligence and Security Committee has decided they're not actually going to question them in front of the cameras at all.
No, and in any case, they're not going to ask the serious questions about are you terrorists. They're just going to ask, have you broken the law about phone tapping? Now, in actual fact, in the modern era, if anybody believes that their electronic communication is secure, they're fools. All electronic communication is hackable, certainly by intelligence agencies like GCHQ. So the real problem is, who will guard the Guardians? The old story. Who will guard the Guardians when we've got documentary evidence that the Guardians, i.e. NATO intelligence services, have fomented and organised terrorism, including Islamist terrorism. Now, people need to wake up. We are on the brink of a totalitarian state here, and it's not because we've got people snooping in our emails, it's because the people in charge are actually criminal terrorists.
Well, computing has said about PRISM and GCHQ, there's nothing to see here, says the Intelligence and Security Committee. Allegations that British spy agency GCHQ illegally tapped global internet traffic and phone calls, which it shared with its US counterpart, the National Security Agency, are unfounded, according to the Intelligence and Security Committee. If this were true, it would be a matter of various secret concern. And would constitute a serious violation of the rights of UK citizens, the Intelligence and Security Committee said. In the past week, though, it says it's now taken what it deems detailed evidence from GCHQ, giving it an all clear.
Yes, well, in intelligence work, you have cutouts. So when I talk about the Western intelligence services being involved in terrorism, we're not talking about the people sitting at their desks in Whitehall or in Cheltenham. What happens is that it's farmed out to intermediary agencies and other groups. And, you have front organisations like Al-Majah Haroon, which has been heavily infiltrated by MI5.
But when you say cutout, what do you mean? Is that the idea that somebody can then take the rap?
Yes. I mean, the assassination and kidnap of Aldo Moro, for example, in Italy, was supposedly carried out by the Red Brigades, but the Red Brigades have been heavily infiltrated by SISMI, the Italian secret services. So the Red Brigades were, in fact, being manipulated by the secret services. And, of course, the secret services want to infiltrate terrorist groups, so that's how they justify it to the politicians. We've got the Red Brigades out there, we've got Al-Qaeda out there, we've got the Provisional IRA out there, we've got to infiltrate them, let us get on with it. But once they've infiltrated them, they then control those groups. That's the goal. I mean, the head of SISMI was interviewed by Frankovic for the BBC 2 film, and he said it was very difficult to infiltrate the Red Brigades at first, but once we were in and we got control of it, it was perfect. Because in a secret organisation, you don't know who's giving you your orders, do you? And it could easily be the secret, you know. So a lot of these Islamist terrorist groups are getting their orders from their bosses further away up the tree, but those bosses are themselves getting their orders from NATO intelligence services.
Martin, you sent me some stuff during the week from a guy called Francesco Cossiga. He's the president of Italy between 1985 and 1992. He said apparently on the 30th, this is a while ago, but I don't know why you've sent me it, and maybe you can explain. November 2007 to the Daily Corriere della Sera, from areas around the Palazzo Chigi, nerve centres of the direction of Italian intelligence, it's noted the non-authenticity of the video is supported by the fact that Osama bin Laden in it confessed that Al-Qaeda was responsible for the 9/11 attacks on the Twin Towers. However, all the democratic areas of America and Europe, with the Italian centre-left in the forefront, now know full well a disastrous attack was planned and executed by the CIA and Mossad with the help of the Zionist world, to falsely incriminate Arab countries and to persuade Western powers to intervene in Iraq and Afghanistan. Now, is that a quote from Cossiga?
That is a quote from Francesco Cossiga, who is the former president of Italy. Now, he may be wrong, but he's the former president of Italy. He's not some stoner in his bedroom.
You think he actually... approves of this way of doing things?
Kosiga was actually implicated in Gladio, and at one stage he was talking when students were demonstrating.
Explain a little bit about Gladio.
Well, Gladio was based at the end of the Second World War. The Russians became the enemy because the fascists had been defeated. So the Western intelligence services recruited lots of ex-fascists into the what they called stay behind units in all European countries. And at first it was justified to the politicians that if the Russians overran Western Europe, there'd have to be sort of people prepared to sort of start a resistance, and we're just preparing for that eventuality. But once these neo-fascist sort of groups were in place, they then started using them to influence the democratic politics of France, Italy, Belgium and places like that. So you had the things like the Brabant massacres in Belgium, where people were just massacred in supermarkets by people wearing Halloween masks, and this was all part of undermining the Belgian socialist government refusal to accept cruise missiles. And of course the message to the political elite in Belgium was very clear: if you do not accept cruise missiles, we're going to carry on shooting people in supermarkets. They got the message and they took cruise missiles.
CFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Another story this week. 10 years it is since the death of intelligence analyst David Kelly. A campaign for a formal inquest, though, carries on. Martin, this is mostly being brought by a bunch of doctors, mm-hmm. and they originally wrote letters to The Guardian, and are running now a campaign. The New Statesman is saying 10 years on, a spectacular failure of accountability.
Yes, I mean, these people are doctors, and what was absolutely obvious, even to the most dim person, is that there was no proper coroner's inquest into the death of David Kelly. They were halfway through the coroner's inquest, and then the government stepped in with the Hutton inquiry and said, oh no, we don't need a coroner's inquest because we've got to have an inquiry into all of this. And the inquiry, of course, is just looking into why he might have committed suicide. It accepts that he did commit suicide. Now, these people are doctors and say, we don't accept that. We just don't accept that he committed suicide.
The amount of blood, this is according to one of them, paramedic Vanessa Hunt, who examined the body, told Hutton the amount of blood that was around the scene seemed minimal. There was a small patch on his right knee, but no obvious arterial bleeding, no spraying of blood or huge blood loss or any obvious loss on the clothing. His jacket was pulled to sort of mid-forearm area, and from that area down towards the hand, there was dried blood, but no obvious sign of a wound or anything, just dried blood.
Yeah, well, most paramedics will know, if they're listening to this, that it's very, very difficult to kill yourself by slitting your wrists. It's actually virtually impossible. In fact, when Roman senators used to do it, they used to have both of their whole forearms opened up by a slave, and then they had to sit in a hot bath to make sure that the blood kept pumping in order to commit suicide by slitting your wrists. Lots of people do it as a kind of, oh, I'm going to slit my wrist. But in actual fact, as any paramedic will tell you, it's virtually impossible to kill yourself by slitting your wrist.
Okay, so what happened?
Well, we don't really know what happened, because, of course, the Hilton inquiry was put up a smokescreen so that we wouldn't find out. But information I am getting is that Dr. David Kelly was one of a group of three people who went to South Africa in the early 1990s to negotiate with the South Africans about buying three nuclear weapons from them. That was Dr. David Kelly, representing the British government as a weapons inspector, Sir Kenneth Warren, who was a big fixer in Tory politics, and a young lad who just got just working at Tory Central Office, one David Cameron. And they did a deal with the South Africans to buy three nuclear weapons, which were then bought by a private company called Astra Holdings, headed by an ex-MI6 officer called Stephen Koch. They were then sold on to the British government at a profit, and the weapons were then moved by the guy they were dealing with, John Bredenkamp, from South Africa to Oman. So Dr. David Kelly went out to Oman to check that they were there and discovered that they weren't there. And so the motivation for the killing of Kelly is not what people think, from what I'm hearing. Kelly knew all about the dirty deals that the British state had been doing about nuclear weapons, and that's why he had to die, because he knew too much.
Well, the Daily Mail has actually been very good and campaigning for what looks like it's to be tomorrow's mail. It says, 10 years ago, Dr. David Kelly's body was found. The subsequent cover-up is one of the great scandals of our age. And it points out that the inquest did open into Dr. Kelly's death on the 21st of July 2003. But 3 weeks later, the then Lord Chancellor, Lord Falconer, ordered it to be adjourned indefinitely.
So in other words, if somebody trips over on the pavement and breaks their leg, and there might be some kind of foul play involved, you have an inquest to discuss it. But when somebody's somebody at his senior level with all the kind of, you know, he's been involved in Britain's nuclear deals for years, suddenly dies. We don't have an inquest to find out whether he committed suicide or not. We just presume he committed suicide, and then we talk a lot of waffle about why he might have done so. And his family, of course, were told that if they didn't accept that he committed suicide, they wouldn't get his pension.
Oh, isn't it really simple? Lord Faulkner is guilty of perverting the course of justice.
You could say that. You could say that, and you could also say that in this country we don't have a rule of law. But then in Italy they don't have a rule of law either. That's why Bologna railway station was bombed by their own intelligence services, etc., working with the British, of course. The British are always at the heart of a lot of this kind of skullduggery around the world, despite our image of ourselves as being squeaky clean and whiter than white. That's not how we're seen in large parts of the world, I'm afraid.
Lord Faulkner correctly believed he'd identified a tame judge friendly to the establishment. In due course, Lord Hutton returned his verdict of suicide, absolving the government of any responsibility for Dr. David Kelly's death. And apparently, Tony Blair appointed that judge to look into the inquiry literally hours after David Kelly's body was found.
Yes, indeed. And you might argue, what has Hutton, who's basically a lawyer, got to say about whether somebody committed suicide or not? Are they a doctor? The answer is no, they're not.
Lord Hutton, again, is not a coroner. And in the view of many observers, he didn't investigate the causes of Dr. Kelly's death as thoroughly as a practice coroner would have done.
Exactly, because if a practice coroner would have discovered he didn't commit suicide, so he must have been murdered. Who murdered him? That's a question, isn't it?
Well, the doctors...
What I was speculating about why he was murdered earlier is just one line of inquiry. We don't really know. But if he was murdered, then basically we need to know who and why. But of course, that's why we're not going to find out, because the secret state in Britain is not to be trusted, despite what they tell us, the parliamentary
well,
committee.
I don't think it's quite good enough to say we're not going to find out. I think at some point we will find out. And, there was a BBC Conspiracy Files documentary which looked at the death of David Kelly, which uncovered all sorts of bits of information. So even though the courts are not dealing with this, it looks like investigative journalists around the world are dealing with it.
Yes, and that's what we're left with when there's no rule of law. It's people like us wallying on the radio.
Okay, Martin, thank you. Another item now, Dr. E.P. Thompson, the historian, and this is a little quote from a book I uncovered recently, has recently discovered behind a panel in his library the diary of a remote ancestor, a minor landowner in Worcestershire, and a JP. The diary is undated, but despite certain discrepancies, it would seem that the extracts published below date from September or October 1593. Now, what it talks about here is the fact that he was privy to a lot of information from judges, and that there was a scandal abroad. It was the markings, apparently, on the buoys up the Channel, which, if known to the Armada, would have sailed up the Thames and anchored off the Isle of Dogs. Some said the Spaniards are already there. The Tower of London is taken. You have to remember, this is in the late 1500s. Nobody really knew what was going in London, in Bristol. It took days for news to get around the country, and that some said the Spanish are already there, the Tower is taken, the Queen and court is fled to Northumberland to raise an army, and the Inquisition is by now on English soil. Now, this is all because, apparently, this is the story, that a seaman has given away the secrets of whereabouts the boys are in the Thames, so the Spanish Armada will be able to sail in. The gentleman was much astonished at the news, and there was a general call for a warrant of hue and cry against all boatswains, such disaffected fellows. But his neighbour, Admiral Salt, who's in the know, took him aside and said this is no more than landlubbers talk, for that in 8 years all the channels have silted and changed, and the boys have been moved around, that every river pilot knows more than this boatswain could have known. That it hath been long published abroad for every eye to read, and even the masters of petty foreign trading vessels have it put down in a little manual. So what he's basically saying is this information that's supposed to have been leaked by this boatswain, everybody knew it anyway, so it wasn't even a secret.
Essentially, it's been a good stroke. This is what he actually says here, to quote, that the Admiral says, "It's been a good stroke to let the common folk suppose that treasons be abroad, in that it may bring them into a better affection with the state." What do you think about that? I mean, a lot of this is about actually scaring the public into thinking there's some sort of terrible threat around, a little bit like the war on terror, in order to make them trust the state more.
Yes, and E.P. Thompson, of course, is a great historian, but I'm afraid I don't think this is actually a historical document, Tony. It's from his book, Writing by Candlelight, which is actually a polemical book rather than...
No, this is this is his historical diary from one of his ancestors.
No,
Yes, it is.
All right, well, maybe... I have my doubts about that. I've only just seen this, but I must say... It strikes me as E.P. Thompson
it's
making...
Not, no, this isn't fiction. This is someone's diary from 1593.
Right. Well, I mean, certainly the British state has always... I mean, the gunpowder plot, for example, is fairly clear that the British state fomented the gunpowder plot. Lord Robert Cecil, who was head of British intelligence at the time, trapped all the people into it and said, hey, why don't you try and blow up Parliament? We'll give you the gunpowder. And then when they tried to blow up Parliament, the rest of them, oh, this is terrible, they're trying to blow up Parliament. Virtually every case in America of terrorism since 2001 have been entrapment cases set up by the FBI. So they go round, find innocent Muslims and say, hey, would you like to blow something up? We'll give you some weaponry to do it. And then when they say yeah, they say, well, we've got you. And of course, in actual fact, the whole purpose of all of this, like people keeping people in Guantanamo and all the rest of it, and the 9/11 attack, just as the bombing in Bologna in 1980, is to terrify the population. And the state has been doing this for hundreds of years. It was doing it in 1593, and when they were just using pen and ink and gunpowder, and they're doing it today with the internet and nuclear weapons.
Well, this is just to go back again to 1593. This is the thing I find so incredible about this, that this has been going on for so many hundreds of years, this kind of thing. It is said that a great trial will be had in London to strike terror into the hearts of the Queen's loyal subjects, and it's already settled that the boatswain shall have his bowels drawn while yet alive, and his head be put on a pike outside the chambers of Mr. Secretary in Whitehall. As for the printers who printed this, it's not yet agreed with the judges, but that they shall be certainly have their ears cut off. Now, all this is, the idea is really to create a great spectacular in front of the public that's got no actual truth to it at all.
Yeah, a bit like 9/11 or the bombing of Bologna railway station. But if we're talking about individuals being singled out in order to terrify others, well, Dr. David Kelly, what would be the motive for killing him? So that anybody else who works for the government realises if you step out of line, you could have a walk in the woods like Kelly.
BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
And on now to our little celebration of the birthday yesterday of Nelson Mandela. And we're going to hear from some of the protagonists in a minute. But first of all, let's go back to 1961 to hear from Nelson himself. And here he is talking to ITN back in 1961, to Brian Widlake.
Up to now, African nationalism has only made itself felt in campaigns of non-cooperation. Where there have been riots in locations like these, they've generally been caused by bad conditions. 2 days before South Africa became a republic, a stay-away strike was organized throughout the country in protest. But most Africans went to work. 10,000 of them were arrested before the strike began. The army was fully mobilized, and an African knows he can be jailed for 3 years if he dares to strike. I went to see the man who organized this stay-away, a 42-year-old African lawyer, Nelson Mandela, the most dynamic leader in South Africa today. The police were hunting for him at the time, but African nationalists had arranged for me to meet him at his hideout. He is still underground. This is Mandela's first television interview. I asked him what it was that the African really wanted.
The Africans want the franchise on the basis of one man, one vote. They want political independence.
Do you see Africans being able to develop in this country without the European being pushed out?
We have made it very clear in our policy that South Africa is a country of many races. There is room for all the various races in this country.
Are there many educated Africans in South Africa?
Yes. We have a large number of Africans who are educated and who are taking part in the political struggles of the African people. The question of education has nothing to do with the question of the vote. On numerous occasions, it has been proved in history that people can enjoy the vote even if they have no education. Of course, we desire education, and we think it's a good thing. But you don't have to have education in order to know that you want certain fundamental rights, you have got aspirations, you have got claims. It has nothing to do with education whatsoever.
Are you planning any more campaigns of non-cooperation?
Yes. The Peter Marisberg resolution makes provision for a campaign of non-cooperation with the government, and we are presently studying plans to implement this aspect of the resolution.
Now, if Dr. Verwoerd's government doesn't give you the kind of concessions that you want sometime soon, is there any likelihood of violence?
There are many people who feel that the reaction of the government to our stay at home, ordering a general mobilization, arming the white community, arresting 10,000 of Africans, the show of force throughout the country, notwithstanding our clear declaration that this campaign is being run on peaceful and non-violent lines, close a chapter as far as our methods of political struggle are concerned. There are many people who feel that it is useless and futile for us to continue talking peace and non-violence against a government whose reply is only savage attacks on an unarmed and defenseless people. And I think the time has come for us to consider, in the light of our experiences in this stay at home, whether the methods which we have applied so far are adequate.
Well, are they? Martin, in a way, that's a little bit of a threat he's making there. He's saying, yeah, we're talking about strikes, but maybe we're going to have to go further. This is almost what you were saying last week about the whole business of Syria and, you know, the balance between a political struggle and an armed struggle.
Yes, and ultimately the ANC decided, perfectly legitimately from their point of view, that they could not use armed methods. Although they never prioritised armed methods, they always saw them as secondary to the political struggle. But on the other hand, you know, if people are oppressing you, ultimately people have got a right to defend themselves against that.
Well, that was from 1961, kind of the beginning of the struggle, and not long after that Nelson Mandela was jailed for many years, but he finally got out, and I can remember watching the TV screens as he got out of jail back in 1990. So let's go back also now to 1990 to hear a little snatch of a speech he made at Wembley Stadium, which was a massive concert for Mandela and for the ANC and for black liberation in Africa.
Thank you very much to you all. Thank you that you chose to care. Because when, by ending the system of white minority domination, humanity will have ensured that never again shall the scourge of racial tyranny raise its ugly head.
Well, the cheering is actually quite incredible. There was something like 10 minutes of cheering, Ed, when Nelson Mandela started his speech before he actually said a word from Wembley Stadium, absolutely jam-packed back in 1990. What's the importance today of Nelson Mandela? Ed Hill's joining us, who's been part of the campaign. He's also part of the Palestine Solidarity Campaign, and he'll be along at this event tomorrow.
Yes, well, there's a lot we can talk about on this, but starting from the beginning, listeners will have will remember that yesterday, Thursday, was Nelson Mandela's birthday. Obviously, he's been very seriously ill, so there's a great deal of concern about him, and this has been a top news story. I was involved in the anti-apartheid movement here in Bristol. I still had the badge somewhere, and I still remember not buying South African oranges and other fruit and products like that. But before we get on to the boycott and what apartheid all was about, you know, Nelson Mandela, since the 90s, you know, has been foremost as a sort of world leader and elder statesman, and has stood for anti-racism and against injustice around the world. But you you know, I'm getting on in years a bit, and possibly a generation has grown up now who knows he's famous, knows he's a great guy, but what's it all about? So I was thinking perhaps very briefly we recap and say, what was apartheid in South Africa?
Yeah, so what was it?
It's hard to imagine that it's bad enough in this country, and I've been listening to your discussions earlier, that the law in South Africa was that the whites were in charge and the blacks didn't count. The whites, I think, had the vote, they ran the country, they had a government, but the blacks, millions of blacks, were used as cheap labour and they counted for nothing. They lived under terrible circumstances in shanty towns, they were paid very low wages, it was all about mining, it was all about quarrying, it was all about agricultural production, and that's what apartheid was, that there was one rule for the whites and there was another rule for the blacks and the browns. And people were strictly categorised into those racial groups, and it was stamped on their ID card, and there were special committees to sort out people who were a little bit in between and decide whether they were black or white or brown. And that's really what institutional racism was, and that's how the law in South Africa ran up until that time. Truly shocking by today's standards, so there's other bad things going on around the world, but that's why people like me, other people in this country, joined the anti-apartheid movement. That was the campaign. Apartheid was South African word meaning apart, apartheid meaning to keep the different races apart.
It's and apart it was hide, apart skin. Yeah.
Right, was it? Yeah. Thank you. And Nelson Mandela, who is elected as the leader of the ANC, rightly fighting back against this injustice by various means, was banged up in jail for, I believe, 26 years, wasn't it? 26 right. years. And me, as a relative youngster, I remember somebody telling me the story, and it's kind of like, what's all this about? I can't believe it. I hadn't heard this before. It hadn't percolated through the mainstream media and impinged on my consciousness. And it's kind of like, that's terrible, you know. And then that's why I joined the movement, and many people, and you could hear them at Wembley Stadium when finally he's released, and then went on to become president of South Africa. So a truly great guy, representing a truly great and important struggle against racism and against injustice.
Martin, do you think it's fair to compare the apartheid that was going on in South Africa with other parts of the world, such as the division in Palestine and Israel?
I think it's absolutely fair. I mean, and people like Mandela have said so, and Desmond Tutu the same. What's going on in Israel-Palestine today is exactly the same as the kind of thing that was going on in South Africa, although the Israeli state has a much better PR department than the white South Africans had, and they are able to convince people that they are the victims, because let's face it, I mean, Jewish people have suffered historically, and there's no doubt about that, and nobody would suggest for a minute that that was not the case. But two wrongs don't make a right. They never did, and they never will.
What about Nelson Mandela himself? Did he actually embrace this whole idea of that you know, you're only going to actually change things through the barrel of a gun?
No, they, as I said before, in Mkhonto we Sizwe, the military wing of the ANC, which was actually led by Joe Slovo, who was a white South African, was very important, but it was not the main focus. They always saw the main focus as mass action and getting people onto the streets. But of course, that's very dangerous. Taking demonstrations onto the streets where they're going to be shot down is demanding an awful lot of people. And of course, as Provisional IRA would say, well, you might be better at creeping up on them in the middle of the night and blowing their head off. And of course, there's a lot to be said for that as well, if you want to save your lives of your own people.
Well, what about the actual effect in South Africa itself, though? Because many people look at the way the other presidents of, I think it's Jacob Zuma and others since Nelson Mandela was president of South Africa. The country's sort of been sliding downhill, hasn't it? I mean, there's a complete problem, well, a lot of problems with the whole justice system, and also it's almost as if the violent thugs are not just white policemen now, there's also black policemen who are thugs.
To be fair, they always were. In situations of injustice, ultimately it's bad people versus good people, and it's actually not skin colour that determines it. As I said, Joe Slovo, who was the leader of the military wing of the ANC, was a white South African, and Ronnie Kasrils, who was his deputy, another white guy, he's written an article recently, and he's getting on now, and he said, we did the right thing to change the constitution. things are far better today in terms of the basic political situation in South Africa than they were before. But the mistake we made, in order to get peace quickly, we gave too much away to the multinational companies, to the IMF, to the Western multinationals. And of course, that's the other aspect why British people should have been concerned about South Africa. A, the history of South Africa. I mean, we fought a war against the Boers to put them in, you know, and then put them in power. And lots of British people died at Spion Kop. Lots of Liverpool Scousers shot dead at Spion Kop. That's why the Kop in Liverpool is called the Kop, because it was those Lancashire Fusiliers that died on Spion Kop. So there's a lot of history between us and South Africa. And the other thing is, British multinationals were the major investors in the country, so there were, you know, people were profiting. People in the City of London were profiting from the exploitation of black workers in South Africa. So there's lots of history there. But the non-racial nature of the new regime, I mean, South Africa's constitution is a model constitution. Just a small thing, gay marriage is absolutely given part of the constitution in South Africa. We're still, the Neanderthals are still arguing over here and bashing each other on the heads with clubs, but in South Africa, which has got very strong anti-gay prejudices in South Africa, it's, you know, there's a very strong anti-gay prejudice through all communities, but the constitution is clear, yeah? People can get married if they're gay. Gay rights are protected by that constitution. But of course, that doesn't really help a starving miner on strike who's being shot by
the police. Absolutely not, as has been recently happening. So, yeah. You know, some of that may be window dressing.
Yes, indeed.
This event, anyway, tomorrow, Nelson Mandela, the 20th of July at the Ark Bar, 27 Broad Street. That's right in the city centre. All the way from Zimbabwe, Bulawayo, Jump Up, guest singer Ruth Moore, Norris B, that Rock Reggae, Jar Garvey, Cultural Reggae, Omar Makeza, and Freeloading Frank, and special guests. £3 suggested donation in aid of the Nelson Mandela Children's Fund. And that's all happening tomorrow at Broad Street. Anything like you'd finally like to add there, Ed?
Come along. It's going to be a great night, and it's a great cause and a great memory, an important piece of history. Come along. Let's have a great time. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Ed. Time to sign off now. Next coming up is Cyrus the Virus and the Typical Topical Afro Tropical Show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Deputy Leader of the Labour Group on Bristol City Council, Councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Thanks also to Ed Hill from the Mandela Party tomorrow, and housing campaigner turned developer Tony Crofts. We're on thisweek.org.uk. We'll take you straight to our BCFM page. I'm Tony Gosling. See you next week.
Community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 7, the wife...